All you diehards, welcome back. Comments are, well, some of us are getting bored with this material, and I understand that. I wouldn't say it's boring, but I think he's boring. So we will try to finish up by, I think we can finish this up by the end of May, and we'll start something new in the fall. My sense of what's going on is that the author consulted with von Franz at the beginning, because I think the book is getting worse. And I think on the basis of what he's written in these last couple chapters, it would never get published. It's just not very good. We'll try to look past what he said to get the essence of it. But my sense is that he got guidance at the beginning of the book, and then he was on his own for the last part. And there was a great difference. I mean, he goes on for pages, and I just turn him. I say, this is just nuts. He gets off into interpretations that are absolutely irrelevant to the material. And, you know, the danger of working with the unconscious is either you have no imagination, which is probably the more likely problem, and you can't entertain a fantasy process around your images, or you get so caught up by the image that you forget to ask what it refers to. And that's this guy's, I think that's our author's danger. I mean, he goes on for four pages about Ezekiel's vision, and there's no mention of four. So you just go out there, and either one is bad, because they're both mechanisms of defense. People will come in and they'll give you these great mythological commentaries, but they never say what the dream means. Now, not so much average people, but more like people who are on the edge of a psychosis or very disturbed people. Intellectual people will do that. Most of the time, the danger is the other way around, that we don't imagine enough. But I think we only have three chapters left, as far as I can see. And we have, 3 weeks left? And I think we'll easily get through one chapter today. We might even get started on the next chapter, because I'm going to skip about half of this chapter. It's just words. But the other sad thing, too, is we're seeing Pauli going to his death. And, you know, I think for me, one of the things I've learned in this work is don't repress your negative feelings for the client. So if you find yourself resenting Pauli, don't be ashamed of it. He is a jerk, and it's natural to resent it. But what we have to be able to do then is separate our feelings for the person from the material. Because if there's any chance of helping them, it's going to be not identifying with that feeling, but going to the material. But if you repress the feeling, you will end up acting out of it. You will become insulting to the person, you'll become rude to the person, just like you would to any other jerk that you have to deal with, you know. If you're dealing with a jerk at work, it's much harder to be nice to a jerk than it is to somebody who's kind. And that's what we call counter-transference. And you pick up the client's own attitude of self-hatred, and you start acting out of that, which is what I feel. When I read this, when I read what Pauli writes now, I think, bullshit, I just turned the page. That's his inner hatred being lived out by my own feelings. But if I'm not aware of it, then I act out of it. So I think it's very important that we allow ourselves these negative feelings, but try not to identify with them. And that's part of the art.
And so are you saying that the self-hatred is actually his defense?
Or it's leading to that, yes. Yeah. I mean, why can't he do what's good for himself? You see what I mean? What's good for him is to follow this relationship with von Franz and to lecture. But instead, he chose death. Something in him hates him. Now, you know, I guess you could say that the Freudian position would be that that's the negative mother complex. That somewhere he had hatred of a parent. He had hatred towards him by a parent that he interjected. I don't know. We don't have any evidence of that. And I don't think it really matters where it comes from. It just matters how it operates. But, you know, this is a very severe case, as you know. the guy might as well shot himself. That's basically what he did. He shot himself. Except he did it respectfully.
So he never became aware of that self-hatred?
Never. No.
Did he ever become aware of the fact that he was turning against himself?
No.
When he was
no. I mean, I'm telling you, this is one of the hard people say, you know, don't you get frustrated doing your work? Basically, I don't. Because you, even though you hear some horrible stories, you see people do change. But the tragedy is people who simply cannot see the most obvious details of the way they are destroying themselves. And he's one of them.
Like, is it like Thomas Aquinas?
I don't think so, like Thomas Aquinas exactly, because I think he did his best with what he had, and then that material broke in on him, and he was not in a position to deal with it simply because the tools were not there, and the worldview of the time was so far from what he was doing. No, this is a guy who could have gone psychotic. I mean, he is a very disturbed man, and the Freudians would call him a high-functioning borderline. And the either the good or the bad, depending on how you look at it, is he functioned very well. He was very messed up. He would have been lucky if he hadn't been able to function so well, in a way.
Then he
would have had to do something about it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So these feelings are part of the work. And, I think it's very important to feel them. I told you about the experience of Anne McGuire and the lecture on love. Did I tell you that story?
In England?
Yeah, I'll repeat it if you haven't heard it. For those who haven't heard it. I was at a lecture of a guy, David Rosen. He's in Texas. Might as well say his name. Doesn't matter. He gave a lecture at a conference in England on love. This is all the thing now. Love, empathy, and psychotherapy. Because see, what do you do with these feelings? Then, well, he finished the lecture and he cited Paracelsus, and my colleague Emmett Guire raised her hand and said, "You know, you lectured to us for an hour and a half on love in psychotherapy. You've quoted Paracelsus. Are you aware Paracelsus was a man who was filled with hate? Are you aware the most important quality of a therapist is not how they love, but how they hate?" And this is what she was talking about. When you're with a very sick person, you will start hating them. And the art is managing that and still staying in relationship to them. Because if you don't, you're being dishonest to the reality of the situation.
And you're saying if you don't,
you end up attacking them. You would say
attacking out their self.
You would say, you know, haven't you felt somewhere along the line like saying, "Pally, you dumb shit, why don't you wake up?"
Mm-hmm.
That's what would come out of a therapist's mouth. That's the danger of working with someone like this. You start attacking them. How can you be so fucking stupid? Well, it doesn't do anything for them. They feel that way anyway. You see what I mean? And you're just expressing what they're feeling, and they will walk away saying, "There's one more person who has put me down."
So how do you? Yeah. So you're saying the delicate balance in how do you express that without going to either extreme, either not expressing it and you swallow it, or over.
Well, I think they're the same. If you swallow it, you will act it out. And you have to be aware of it, and if there's a positive value to it, it would be what would allow you the strength to set boundaries. No. And they're constantly testing you. Okay. We're on 204.
204?
Aren't we?
You said to read through 201.
Oh, sorry. We must not be on 204.
You really do want to move through this.
I've been reading farther than 201.
Sorry, wrong. We are at 183. We're at 183. Which we are 204.
I guess it depends on where you are in the soul's journey and your path. Is that sometimes I realize that he's kind of taking off on a tangent, but for me, it's an opportunity to learn something about, you know, it may not have a lot to do with the person, but sometimes it's helpful for me to learn something new that I wasn't aware of. It's
well,
kind of strange.
Be careful, because I've had this dialogue in my head as well. Well, it is interesting material, but, you know, it's always a little bit skewed.
It is.
Yeah. If, when we do that, we are repeating the material in a way that's just a little bit off. So you're liable to come away with the wrong feeling about the material or a half understanding about the material. And I think that's the danger.
Somewhere in here, I'll give you just a brief example. I've, for a long time, I've been wanting to penetrate into this term called the son of man.
Yeah.
And
we'll get there.
You would probably call that a tangent. Because he's talking about
it. It is a tangent, but we can mention it briefly.
But he stands on something that is one of the most important things I've been trying to find a handle on.
Mm-hmm.
And that for that reason, even though it's a tangent, I want to know what he says.
Okay, look at it.
I'm just saying how it comes out at me.
Yeah.
Is that from a Christian point of view, though?
It's probably Christian, yeah,
or
but it's
Jesus
a larger,
Paul
yeah.
Thing,
yeah, but I think it means something that is not clear in Christian theology yet.
I agree. It's,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, just a quick summary. Last time we talked about the three-egg dream, remember? Four-egg dream. And then we talked about the concept of symmetry.
Did you say four eggs?
Four eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And then we talked about the concept of symmetry, which just, practically speaking, means that what we're trying to establish is that what is inside us, we communicate to the outside world. So to try to establish the existence outside of what's inside. In his case, the point of view of Sophia and Mercurius, this relativity of matter and spirit. Then we had that important sentence that the light anima has a secret, illegitimate relation with the devil, and the dark anima has a relationship with the true spirit. We're back to dealing with Pali's denial, and on 183, he mentions a discussion with Gillis Crystal, who was I don't know whether he's still alive or not, but a pretty well-respected scholar in Gnosticism. And Crystal just, you know that, remember the Nag Hammadi finds? Some influential Zurichers bought one of those tractates and donated it to the Jung Institute. So it's, I don't know if it's at the Jung Institute anymore, it's probably in a vault somewhere, but it was named the Jung Codex. And Crystal was instrumental in doing that. That's how he gets into the picture. And he reports how Pali told him the importance of Schopenhauer. Remember, Schopenhauer didn't want to accept the idea that God was conscious because he couldn't look at the suffering of humanity. Therefore, God could not be conscious. No one could look at the suffering of humanity. And again, if we take that as a metaphor, that means that Pali is back to that old position of not wanting to look at the suffering that he's causing other people.
So Schopenhauer said God couldn't be conscious because there was no way God could look at the suffering, be conscious of the suffering of man and
right.
accept it.
Right. So therefore God must be unconscious. Yeah. Which means that Pali is unconscious of, or the self is unconscious in Pali. That's 183. Nothing new. 184, I think the really only important sentence there is what we've already said, the last paragraph. Pali does not take seriously his own idea concerning a symmetry between physics and depth psychology. And we're going to see the relationship with von Franz now, which is in the paragraph above it. It's on and off, on and off, on and off, till it finally stays off. What he's doing now, he's getting interested in biology. We talked about that, I think. To see if he could see statistically in evolutionary experiments how patterns come out of randomness. Does that make sense? Evolution is supposed to be random, right? And yet, here we are. We're a patterned human being. And on the personal level, what that would mean for Pauli is to recognize that if he can accept these synchronicities, i.e. von Franz in his life, that that's part of his pattern. But rather than feelingly deal with that, he goes off intellectually into investigating patterns in evolution. That was her big complaint about his doing that. And he went to America to meet this guy Delbruck, who was doing research. And apparently it was a disastrous meeting. Delbruck did not get excited with Pauli on what he was trying to find in biology. That takes us to 186, which is the important part of this chapter. A red snake is lying before the door of a house I want to enter. I'm afraid of it, but I know that it has likewise become afraid of me on that account and will strike, even though I don't consider it an evil creature. I don't know, however, how I'm to break this spell of fear. The snake turns toward me and I scream and awake in a fervent fright. Then I went to sleep again and dreamt further. It is daylight and I am in a new scientific institute. Instead of the snake, a red gobelin hangs on the wall. I write a petition to the administration for the wider development of the laboratory, and in the contact also the name Jung is mentioned.
What's a red gobelin?
Well, I had to look that up. Anyone ever heard that word before? It's a tapestry.
Oh, I know what it is, the gobelin.
Oh, gobelin, is that how it's pronounced?
That's it.
Oh, it's a French.
That's gobelin.
Gobelin. And what gives it its name, do you know?
Well, the background is red, actually.
It's a wall hanging, I believe.
Yeah,
it's a tapestry that's used as a wall hanging.
Yeah. And it's actually unicorns.
Oh, it's a specific pattern.
Well, it's a combination, a series of patterns.
But a unicorn is among them.
The unicorn is the center.
Center, interesting. He doesn't mention that.
Well, if I think of it, I'll bring my plate next time.
Oh, you have a gobelin, gobelin?
I have one plate. And I have all the blue ones.
Bring it. Do bring it.
So okay. Is it a specific scene or is it a genre of scene
it's
that are considered?
It's really the queen, and I don't know the whole unicorn story, but anyhow, it's different stages of unicorn with the queen and the wherever.
And the queen is involved, huh?
Is it
Mary?
No, I don't think so.
In the Grail Legend,
is it
that a series?
I don't know.
The unicorn, of course, is Yahweh. And there's a medieval legend that a virgin tames a unicorn. And that's supposed to be parallel to the fact that Mary conceived of Yahweh and produced Christ. So in so doing, made God more gentle. That's the basic idea there. Uh-huh. It's a pretty frequent image in medieval literature and art, the unicorn.
Yeah, medieval museum. New York
has it, huh?
The whole blue gobelin and the museum and press, the name of which I can think of, has the red.
Huh. Well, see, the horn of the unicorn and the snake would be parallel then. That's really a nice amplification. You follow that?
Say it again.
The horn of the unicorn and the snake would be parallel. See, the snake here is cancer.
Cancer.
We don't know it now.
His actual cancer in his body, or something?
It's what I think is what is going to come is personified in the snake. That the his task, which we first saw, well, we've seen it of course many times, but we saw it most recently in the game of chess with Sophia. Sophia was of the earth. Snake is of the earth. So the snake would be like the earthy side of Sophia. And she wanted to, remember, she wanted him to lecture, Chinese moon raised to the level of Sophia. He is to play chess, there, which meant to engage in understanding his transcendental pattern and putting it in time and space. So the snake now is just that image coming back in a low and destructive form because he has ignored what she wanted at the higher level.
Cold-blooded.
And that's the cold-blooded aspect of the self. Absolutely. See, and it would rather kill him than let him live avoiding his task. Red would be probably passion and also the danger of blood, I would think. So this is the beginning of the end now. That's a very ominous dream.
So the unicorn is Yahweh.
Yeah, it jabs. See, the unicorn jabs, and the snake bites.
So this is the thing that cuts through the truth?
It cuts through.
To
the truth, in the best sense of the word, and cuts you in the worst sense of the word. The snake's aggression and the unicorn's horn would be the intentionality of the unconscious, which, if you go with it, will bring you fertility, and if you fight it, will bring you death. They're your two choices at this point of the game. So you can't dabble with the unconscious too long before it feels it's made an investment in you. Certainly not as long as he has. And certainly not if you have the sort of talent that he has. So that Sophia now is turned into a poisonous snake. It's still not too late if he could come to grips with it, but he doesn't. So this could be the vaccination that saves him or the disease that kills him, and it's the disease that kills him. A dream like this is not untypical early on in the work, but later on it's cause for concern. Why, after all this work, would the unconscious be so intent on attacking? We should have established a relationship to it by now. And the next dream is simply restates the issue in another form, that what that snake wants is a laboratory in which physics and Jungian psychology coexist. It's still not hopeless, but it's getting to be the 11th hour. And again, the reason I feel it's worth sticking this material out, you see how the unconscious doesn't give up. And yet, it's beginning to show that it can become lethal. So there's an image of destruction on the one hand and of creation on the other, all on the same night. And he has 4 years to live. So that snake, you see, is intent on killing him, either metaphorically or literally. Metaphorically would be the death would be the loss of his old stubbornness, the loss of his arrogance, the loss of his addiction to respectability, and the physical death would be, and the other death would be a physical death. He's going to die one way or the other, is the message. And if he can die in the service of beginning to blend Jung and physics, then there's a chance he could live. Usually in these tragic cases of either a psychosis or a death, there's a point where you can find they went wrong. And this is it. And it's usually quite simple. That's the tragedy. From the ordinary person's point of view, if you would just do this, you could have a full life. But no. They will not. At the same time, there's a break in the relationship with Juan Franz. Which, as I mentioned, I think is differentiated feeling. When she feels he is not pursuing himself, she couldn't be bothered. That, to me, is real relationship. I'll be with you when you are with you. And as the author says in 187, whenever a snake appears, it symbolizes a piece of instinctive psychology in ourselves that is simply inaccessible, something of tremendous power. A thing that is inexorable and that we cannot make compromises with. Whenever such a monstrous animal appears in a dream, we know that it is something coming up from the unconscious which is not to be influenced by willpower. It is like a fate that cannot be twisted.
The source for that quote. It says DAS?
Dream Analysis Seminar.
Oh, okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
That was the dream of the crocodile. Yeah. He goes into a amplification, which puzzled me for a while, but I think I finally figured out. He talks about the snake and the crown. And I brought along a couple of pictures. This is from the visions, just to show you how these images appear in completely different contexts. And this is from a Gnostic ring. And I think the point of that is just to drive home. We think of a snake as lowly, but he's mentioning that in myth very often the snake is divinized and it's wearing a crown. To establish this is not just a lowly animal, this is the instinctive dimension of a higher principle. Sophia, yeah. That makes sense? The instinctive dimension. She is really the process of becoming aware of our pattern of being through what situations the instincts bring to us. And here, the snake would just be that instinctive dimension of her.
Is there any understanding where that idea comes from?
Which idea?
The rawness of the snake.
Where it comes from?
Yeah. Does that have an outcome?
Well, the one that's going around, that's Gnosticism.
That's Gnosticism.
So I, certainly one of the early is Gnosticism, and I think, you know, you could think a little bit in reverse that in Egypt the king has a snake's head on its crown. So there, the king is crowned with a snake. Here, a snake is crowned with the king. But I bet they're similar ideas. That the highest principle and the lowest principle aren't separate.
Down here?
Yeah. That's page 187.
Well, I guess what I was thinking is that it's counterintuitive from the gospel, I mean, the biblical tradition where the snake is the bad guy.
Right.
In Genesis.
Exactly.
So there must have been some new thinking down the way.
Or old thinking that had been squashed and is insisting on its return. That's what I think is really going on. Yeah.
The lady with the 12 crowns, the lady with the 12 stars,
mm-hmm.
and she's definitely very real on a snake.
In?
That picture I brought in.
Oh. Yeah, she's not stepping on it in an aggressive way, but
no.
She's touching it with her foot.
Yeah, that's her stance.
Yeah, boy, that's it, Ted.
He's supporting her. I don't. But that's in the cathedral.
Yeah, it's
in
the Immaculate Conception,
Season of Mortification. Uh-huh. And, right. It's one of the early, I think, one of the earlier depictions of the Blessed Mother.
So that she's overcome with snake?
It's not like there's a fight. The snake is on the earth, I think on the globe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in between the earth, the snake is in between the earth and her.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not squishing it or hurting it.
She has palm piece of it.
Under one million years, I don't know if it was a dream or an image or what, but I did a lot of research on it. And it's really amazing because, you know, you get the spiritual aspect of the snake and at the same time the evil
aspect
of the snake, and that's why there's so much fear around, I think. I mean, people just really don't like snakes. They, evil in one sense, but then on the other, that sense of spirituality
right.
that they give, and we're scared of both of them.
Right.
So there's a real resistance to it. I mean, it's a real ambiguous thing.
Very
ambiguous. Yeah.
And it also doesn't have very many different meanings, different religions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what we're looking at now is just certainly one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But what Ted said, I think, is, if you wanted to think of an image, is that in Christianity, the snake is bad. And in Gnosticism, the snake is the savior. And now, that is an image of the whole difference and why Christianity has come to the end of its usefulness for many people. Because they are saddled with the snake. Pauli was saddled with the snake in the form of his lust for von Franz. And it's not bad. It's his mode to salvation. It's his way to salvation. If he could only understand it that way. And we're finding that more and more and more. What the church has called bad is exactly, if you want to use that language, God's entry into a person's life if they know how to work with it.
Well, if you look at the story of Adam and Eve, you know, and the snake is on the tenth of them, I mean, what I now understand from that is that snake is asking them to become conscious. So the snake is playing not an evil part, but positive,
the
whole story, instead of being
something that took them out of paradise, it led them to consciousness.
Yep. Okay.
He does, but he doesn't.
You didn't know then.
Yeah.
He does. She does now. Okay, 190. If you haven't got any questions. What I'm going to do, I'm going to skip about half the chapter, as I said, because I think he gets way off. Unless you've got questions, I'll gladly entertain them, but I'm going to say, here, I'll skip over to you guys if you have any questions. If not, we'll move on. And I think what we'll try to do is focus on the dreams. They don't lie. More problems. 190, he doesn't discuss it in much detail, but the author mentions that in the dream, you see after the quote, after that he dreams, that three popes give him a new house. With the train ticket he is given, should be the, with a train ticket he is given, he will travel to this house. But then he observes, I regret very much that my wife is not present, for what can I do in a new house without her? So, remember that his wife was a sensation type. We'll see that in a moment. So, it suggests more this uncommitted archetypal thinking. That there's no function to tie it to reality. And more trouble, therefore. In other words, the unconscious is saying, do you realize, pal, you have these great thoughts, but you don't have any way of making them real? And the three popes, again, would be a Trinitarian image, and it's the quaternity that would indicate the other function, in his case, the sensation function. What I find so strange, really, in all this stuff, is how she could have put up with this. Because on page 191, they develop a closer relationship. So they're back now. Noteworthy now is that the dream occurred at the time when Pally and Florence begin saying do to each other. That's a big deal. It isn't so much now, but it certainly was then. If you have the two forms of speech, Z and do. Formal and informal. And it's really thou. So today it's just, I think most kids now all say do to each other, and in France, I don't know what it's like. They're still...
It's almost all two.
All two. Like with this little village I go to, it's very clear. Some people speak vous to each other and certain speak too. It's absolutely clear.
Is it partly age differentiated?
No.
No?
No, it's not.
Like teachers
to
get the
vu. No, there is. You have your vu friends and your two friends. Oh, and it's very clear who says what to whom. It's very weird for us. But I kind of like it because no waiter comes up to you and says, hello, my name is Rolf. Tonight, it's very clear we are not pretending to be friends or we are friends. And so this thing of this buddy who stabs you in the back, it cuts through a lot of that. I mean, that's old world thinking. I'm sure young people would say I'm old-fashioned even in that. But I do see the value of it. It used to really annoy me. Calling people my own age, mister. You do that still. I mean, you did even when I was in Switzerland. But that means that we're not buddies, and don't assume we are. Don't ask me for favors, and I won't ask you for one. So at that time, I think even people would have parties when they would begin saying do to each other. It was a really big deal. And it meant we are now special friends. So in spite of all that, she's back. I don't quite understand why, but she is. And I mention that because it's necessary to understand the next dream. Actually, I forgot to write down the information. It's dream 37, and it occurred 28 August 1954. I'm riding on tram number 5 to a larger new house. So that larger new house would probably be the relationship with von Franz, given what just happened. Or connected with that. It's probably more than that, but connected with that. It is at the ETH in new premises. In the tram stop, I take a footpath that winds slowly up a hill and finally leads into the house. In the house, I find my office, and on a table there are two letters. In one of the letters, signed Pullman, it says, Ferry Dues Settlement. The bill is very long with lots of pluses and minus additions. The final total is 568 Swiss francs, which I have to pay. At that time, that would have been a lot of money. Maybe like a few thousand dollars. The second letter is an envelope on which it says Philosophical Choral Society. I open it and find beautiful red cherries, some of which I eat. So the new house, as I said, I think is linked up with von Franz. And insofar as von Franz is linked up with his creativity, it would mean the unconscious is giving him yet another chance to deal with this issue of her and her meaning for him. The serpentine path, I like what he says here, that it is not a straight and narrow. This is a snake that he has to deal with. So, see, the snake that was threatening him before is back. There was a threat, here it's an opportunity. The bill, of course, is that the payment he has to make. Let's read what Jung says about it. On 192. The new house is probably a new relationship to reality. See how tactfully he puts that? That's what I find so amazing about him. You see the care he's giving. It just doesn't, these books that trash Jung, it doesn't fit. That you hear, you see what a jerk Pally was, and he keeps coming back with language that Pally could accept. If he had said, it's about your relationship to von Franz, Pally would have flipped out. But he says a new relationship to reality, which is neutral enough to allow Pally to hear something of the truth, but not get freaked out by it. That, again, is differentiating feeling. Now, take or leave this part. I don't know what to make of this. The total of the digits of 5, 6, 68 equals 19, 9 plus 1 equals 10 equals 1. Numerology. That the work requires the whole man. So, again, it's put, can you see how he's speaking in a veiled way? The whole man would be the man in relationship with von Franz. But he's saying it in a very veiled fashion. One, the universe, the whole person, the microcosmos corresponding to the macrocosmos. The fair, according to the evidence of the total of the digits, one, probably means that the task can only be solved by the fact that the one, which is also the whole, has been attained. That one advances as far as the archetypes and their dynamics, meaning that one must draw practical conclusions from one's perceptions. This, of course, is not strictly science, but science appliqué. It shouldn't be an S on the end of appliqué. It's a typo. If you French freaks might notice that.
So that means how it's applied?
Well, yes, science applied. I think you could almost say technology, applied science. I think that's what he means. That now, if we translate that into normal language, he's speaking to Pally's thinking function here. If we would translate that into normal language, it would be Pally. You've got to start acting like a whole human being who has feelings for a woman and has a task to complete because they are a unity. That's putting it directly. And you call yourself a scientist, so now start taking your experience as seriously as you take scientific data and draw conclusions from it. It's so tactful. I mean, I'm envious of the tact.
Or that might, I mean, it stands the greatest chance of waking up. Not what you say about it.
You know, it, now getting back to our earlier statement, the resentment in us would want to say, Pally, why can't you just take von Franz as she is? That would never get across. That would be a misuse of that resentment. Jung must certainly be feeling that resentment, because he's hearing from von Franz how she's being treated. Pally has broken off the friendship with him, which would have hurt his feelings, I'm sure. But yet he comes back with this language to reach Pally's level of consciousness. Now, I think, comes the real punchline. The cherries are definitely concrete eroticism sublimated into the philosophical choral society. So he takes his feelings and he turns them into thoughts. And then he says, I noted with satisfaction the expression philosophical choral society. It is typical of you to choose to convert the envelope with the red cherries into music, whereas I am afraid that is meant in very specific terms. You see what he's saying there. The fruit is what he is to experience with von Franz, and there's no point trying to sublimate it. Eating of the cherries is a serious matter, insofar as it has its prelude in the apple in paradise, which, as is commonly known, led to the original sin, to the fortunate mistake, which is responsible for redemption. Kapowie.
That's pretty.
That's pretty direct. You know, people often ask me, well, do you have to live it out? And here I think you see the kind of dreams that say yes. When nature is crucified unnaturally, then it's a warning. You are trying to avoid a step of life where something has to be lived and a mistake made, which is a central image to our tradition.
So the training within Eden Cherries was a positive. Right?
Well,
trying to get into it. You'll be able to do it.
No, I think it shows that he's trying to deal with his emotions through thought, not through real experience.
But he did eat the cherries, right?
But they were philosophical cherries.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And not real cherries. Now, Pally, here again, I think we've, you know, with these people, you get a flipping in and out of sanity, really. The next statement from Pally is a solid one, if he could only understand it. It's a solid one, a valid one. What he says now is true. But remember, if you can think of these people, I don't know if you know people like this, who say one thing one minute and one thing the next. So there's really different complexes in there, different people in there, and the person who's speaking now is the healthy part of Pally. But it won't last long. That's the problem. It's not connected up with any other structure of consciousness. Remember, the definition of the ego is continuity of consciousness. So what you say one minute, you follow through with. That's ego consciousness. When you say one thing one minute and one thing the next, that is not, there is no ego there. There's consciousness, but there's no ego. There's awareness of the different states, but there's never a summing up. Watch some of your more disturbed friends, and you'll see this very clearly. One thing one minute, one thing the next. But here is a healthy statement.
Once they believe the one thing and then the one thing next.
They will, they do.
They do, yeah.
Absolutely they do.
Because they're that screwed up.
They're that screwed up. This is fragmentation. This is absence of ego. Right.
But it's what's that? It's not ego.
It's pure unconsciousness. See, we think unconscious means unaware.
Mm-hmm.
But the way you're using the word unconscious, you may be aware of these different states, but you're not aware of their relationship to each other. And if you're not aware of their relationship to each other, there's no consciousness. The synthesis of the two letters is not yet achieved, since the fairy dues have not yet been paid. Such a synthesis has to go back as far as the emotional source of the natural sciences. Now that's why I went off into that discussion of the two dreams, the four eggs and the metal, the tones engraved, I forgot what the dream was. The spectral lines and the splitting of the hydrogen and the metal plates to show you how science can have an emotional basis if the scientists can feel the images behind their work, and those images show up in dreams. And that's what he means by the emotional source of the natural sciences.
Now this is Pauly talking.
This is Pauly talking, and that's true. But we've seen how he went into that point of view for a while, and then he flipped out of that point of view when he starts saying that psychology will be absorbed by physics. Such a synthesis has to go back as far as the emotional source of the natural sciences, which also means going back to the archetypes on which they are based and their dynamic force. This synthesis will no longer be a science typo, will no longer be science but religion. A religion of oldest in which natural science will find its natural place. Now that is solid stuff. But he's not saying physics will absorb psychology. He's saying religion will absorb physics. And that I buy. This is a statement anticipating the future.
Close. I can't understand how he could revert out of it.
Yeah. Well, that's fragmentation.
I mean, that's really, you know, this really has a lot more.
It's even
right now.
It's even brilliant, I think.
Yeah,
that
I do
statement.
Too.
Yeah, it's even brilliant. In other words, where we are headed, if we are at all on target, is a new relationship to images. It's what we're trying to do in analytic work. And as we've seen, there is as much an image behind scientific creativity as there is behind artistic creativity. And that's the way to the synthesis. A rebirth of true symbolic living. Both for the images in the scientific dimension and in the artistic dimension, and in daily life, because as far as the unconscious is concerned, they're all the same. And that's where I think Jungian psychology fits in and why it's so important. Jung at least tried in an individual way to begin this reevaluation of images. Where churches become something out there, which really doesn't mean much to most people, those dogmatic images. And what we're trying to do is find a living source of images on the inside. Maybe in time that will populate a new religious field. Who knows? I think it will. I think we're talking here long term. But this is where I think the work is so important, and it's worth the pain in the butt to go through this stuff. Now, our author gets into a journey to Ezekiel, which I will summarize and then pass on. Maybe 192, 193, 194, really less than chapter 195, 196, 197. Let me summarize the point, and then we'll take a break, and then I'll come back and just look at one small aspect of it, which you don't need here, but you will need for the next chapter. What the author does is just go to the vision of Ezekiel, which really I think is not necessary. But it does fit in a certain extent because of Jung's emphasis on the one. And as far as the unconscious is concerned, the number one and the number four are almost the same. Now, the vision of Ezekiel was of God on a chariot with four wheels. So you see, we've got one and four. That's what he's doing. I think if you know that, that's enough. That's the main point.
What?
That one and four are the same. And that, in fact, Jung says, it's quoted in here, I've also come across in other places, that he based his concept of the self on the vision of Ezekiel.
Jung did that?
Yeah.
Differentiated wholeness. And then the four is differentiated.
It's both. Hang on, we're going to come to that in a minute. I'll look at that. I wanted to explain to you why he went into the vision of Ezekiel for many pages, and it's really too many, I think. And how Jung thought that was an important vision and based his concept of the self on it. I think the other thing about the vision of Ezekiel, those four wheels are terrifying in different ways. And it's just, Jung liked that so much because it's not a prissy image. It's a fiery image of the self. And self experiences are generally full of fire. They're scary. And you do get that awesome aspect in the vision of Ezekiel, which you don't find anywhere in the New Testament. So one and four is the main point. The scary aspect of the four is another point. Ted's question remains, and we'll address that. But I just wanted to show you how he goes from 568 to Jung's one to the vision of Ezekiel, because there's one person on the throne and four wheels. Because pretty soon we're going to start talking about four again. And that's the chain of symbolic logic.